can right now.
Start with Keith. Keith says, I have been suffering with a chest infection since October 2025. I've recently been diagnosed with bronchiectasis. What?
You saw it coming, didn't you?
I did not go to medical school or
speak that. It's a tough one to say that.
Bronchiectasis. I've not been prescribed any medication for my condition, which needs no introduction. Rand, any advice?
So, the condition is bronchiectasis.
It's
a long-term condition where airways become damaged, they become widened and thickened, they make too much mucus, and that causes a persistent cough, and it can cause recurrent chest infections. Now, it's not curable, but we do often use treatment to control those symptoms, reduce flare-ups, slow progression. So you might be on inhalers, which have got steroids in them. You might be on courses of antibiotics, sometimes long-term regular preventative antibiotics. Now, not everyone needs regular medication. It's usually just considered for people with frequent exacerbations. Once you're diagnosed, your GP or your respiratory specialist should come up with an individual management plan for you. And that could also involve a respiratory physiotherapist. These are experts who will teach you things like airway clearance and breathing techniques, which are all designed to help get that mucus out and off your chest. Increasing your airway clearance doing those exercises during infections helps prevent them worsening as well. When you have an infection, when you have a flare-up, we often take a sputum sample, and that's a sample of your mucus, and that gets tested to see if we can identify a bug in there and prescribe the most appropriate antibiotic. But the things that you can do at home which will really help is staying physically active and staying well hydrated, and that keeps the mucus thinner and makes it easier to clear.
Hopefully that's helpful to Keith with your chest infection. Next question is from a viewer who says, I have macular edema in one eye. I've been treated with regular injections for 4 years. Is there a cure?
Well pronounced there, Gethin. Macular edema is swelling that's caused by fluid that's leaking into the macula at the back of the eye. So that's like the central part of your retina that's actually responsible for sharp vision. So treatment for macular edema, which is more common than people think, it aims to reduce that swelling and protect the sight. And sometimes that can help improve the vision. And like our viewer was saying, they are getting injections into the eye, and that's one of the treatment forms. Now, whether it can be cured actually depends entirely on the underlying cause. So if inflammation is the underlying cause, then treating that inflammation can help resolve some of that edema. But if it's caused by a chronic condition, for example, something like diabetes, then the ongoing leakage that you get from the damaged blood vessels in diabetes usually means that treatment controls rather than cures the condition. So it's well worth having a chat with your eye specialist about this, because they can explain whether treatment is actually intended to cure the underlying cause or sort of provide long-term management. But just as a side note altogether, if you get any sudden deterioration in your vision, you should be assessed urgently. So that might mean pop along to your local A&E, and if they've got an eye department, pop along to them and get assessed properly.
One viewer has asked, can the doctor tell me if diarrhoea and headaches can be a symptom of heat stroke?
Yes, they absolutely can be. So headache is a relatively common symptom of heat exhaustion and heat stroke. Diarrhoea is less common, but it can occur. So other symptoms that you want to be looking out for, particularly in heat stroke, are very high temperature, hot skin that might be dry, or maybe sweating a little bit, rapid breathing, fast heart rate, and confusion or restlessness. Heat stroke is a medical emergency. You should be calling 999 or going to your nearest A&E. Before heat stroke happens, you often get heat exhaustion, which is the warning sign. And symptoms of this can be tiredness, dizziness, headache, feeling sick, excessive sweating, cramps, feeling irritable. And that, if that's not managed, then heat stroke develops when the body's cooling systems fail. And that, as I said, is a medical emergency. Remember that babies, older adults, people with long-term health conditions are more at risk. But if someone does have heat exhaustion, which is those symptoms are included that I've just listed, make sure you move them somewhere cool. cool their fan, they cool their skin using either a fan or cool water. You might want to use damp cloths or a spray. Remove any unnecessary clothing. Encourage them to drink fluids if they're able to drink safely, and they should improve within about 30 minutes. Now, if they don't, or if their symptoms get worse, call 999 or go to your local A&E.
Okay. Headaches make sense, don't they, in the hot weather if you're not hydrated properly. This is from Christine. I keep getting tingling in my foot, mostly my right, she says, but it can be both. It's just before my heels. What could cause this?
Interesting one, this one, because there could be a number of things at play here. So tingling or pins and needles has many different possible causes. So assessment really depends on getting that full clinical picture. So simple causes could include things like pressure from footwear, poor posture, standing or sitting in one position for too long. You could have an underlying medical problem that's at play here. For instance, conditions like diabetes, vitamin deficiencies, nerve problems in the feet, or the nerves originating from the lower back. Tingling can also, around the heel particularly, can be caused by a condition called tarsal tunnel syndrome, which is a little bit like carpal tunnel syndrome that you get in the hands and wrist. And this is where the tibial nerve, which runs down the lower leg and into the foot, gets compressed at the ankle, and that gives you symptoms. It's really important that we identify triggers such as particular shoes or activities. And because those symptoms are recurring and affecting both feet, I think it's well worth seeing your GP or a healthcare professional for an examination to check for the pattern of sensation, to check your circulation and see if we can identify any particular underlying cause. Again, like I said before, red flags to look out for, to seek urgent medical attention, as if that tingling is accompanied by things such as weakness, loss of bladder or bowel control, and any sort of numbness around the buttocks or groin region, something we call saddle numbness.
You gave us great advice at the top of the show, Ranj, for people who may have stayed up and watched the football. You said if you're feeling a bit sleepy, get yourself outside, get some fresh air. Well, we also want some advice for people who may have been screaming at the television, understandably. Captain Harry Kane gave an interview post-match. He sounded understandably, deservedly a bit croaky. Let's have a look.
Yeah, it was a crazy game. We had to fight. We had to find something. I've just been sitting there. I can't really talk.
You can't blame him,
though. No, it's absolutely right. Listen, there'll be plenty of people who have a bit of a sore throat this morning after screaming at the television and all that drama. Yes. What's your advice?
Well, he's got that from overuse and overstrain. And the best thing that you can do in that situation is voice rest. Just shut up. Voice rest. Plenty of hydration. Important point to note, though, is if you've got a hoarse voice and it's lasting for several weeks, particularly over 2 weeks, you should be seeing a health professional. Get them to have a look down and see if there's anything going on with the vocal cords themselves that needs treatment. But, yeah, he just needs to shut up for the rest of the day.
But if you say for 2 weeks, he'd be shouting for the next 2 weeks if England go all the way, you know? So maybe wait till the end of the World Cup. I don't know.
As long as he shuts up till Saturday.
Yeah. Thanks for all your messages on this. If you've got a health issue you want advice on, then WhatsApp us on 0800 032 1100. That's 0800 032 1100. Put the word doctor in your message and we will try our best to answer your questions on the show.
A growing number of homeowners are being left with questions over who is responsible for the street that they live on. Now, this is something Morning Live viewer Chris asked us to look into.
Yeah. Because if there's a problem with potholes, drains or street lamps, you might assume it was a job for the local authority. But as presenter Zoe Hardman has been hearing, for residents on new build estates, the road to repair doesn't always run smooth.
The road outside your home might not get much of your attention unless something needs fixing. Traditionally, this has been the responsibility of the local council, but some streets, especially on newer estates, aren't looked after by the local authority. They're known as unadopted roads, and they can cause problems so severe that even buses can't run along them.
We are very lucky to live where we live, but it's just very difficult to see the end of this.
The Home Builders Federation found that only 10% of new housing developments built between 2022 and 2025 had been handed over to local authorities for adoption.
Unadopted roads can often be found on new build estates like this one. They may look finished, appear on maps, and still receive post and deliveries. But when repairs are needed, residents can find the responsibility isn't straightforward.
Dave Whitehead moved into his new build home in Cheshire in 2012. He loves his community, but says life on a mainly unadopted estate isn't always simple.
If there is an issue on the estate, there's a problem with something, who do the residents speak to about it?
We're on a large site here with five different developers and at least two management companies. So it depends on your issue and depends where you are. I live in a house that's been built by one developer, and literally outside my door, the pavement and the road is managed by a different one.
When Dave moved in, the estate was still being built. But when it was finished, he assumed the local council would take over.
Dave, at the point of sale, were you given anything in writing to tell you when the roads would be adopted?
No. You get the deeds and you just assume that's the next stage in the process.
And then nothing happened?
And then nothing happened for 13 years.
Do you feel like the estate feels finished?
Definitely not. The roads haven't been finished, they haven't got the top surface on, and exactly the same with the pavement. So there's lots of trip hazards. Driving up and down an uneven road every day takes its toll on the car. So, yeah, it costs more than it should do.
On this estate, problems with sewers and drainage need to be fixed before the water company will adopt them. And this is having a knock-on effect.
I think the developers, I sort of understand, are not willing to put the final surface on the roads and the pavements until they are sure they don't need to dig them up again.
There are other amenities missing from the residents' daily lives, including public bins and traffic management measures. And there should be buses, but the operator of the planned service says it can't run safely due to significant potholes, unsuitable bus stop positions and excessively heavy speed humps.
We really do need to see a bus service down at the end of the estate.
So what happens to people that live a mile down the road?
It's a long walk.
All this is denting the confidence of both existing and potential residents.
It's not something people want to do, is to buy a house on an estate with an unadopted road.
What do you want to see happen?
They've got to sort these drains out. The second they sort the drains out, there's no excuse then to finish the roads, finish the pavement and start the adoption process.
While Dave expected his road to be adopted, Mark Randall always knew his wouldn't be. When he bought his new home in West Sussex in 2020, he knew the roads on the development would remain private and he'd be paying fees to a management company.
How much do the management fees cost?
In theory, the rent charge is uncapped, but it's about £300 to £350 a year. But in theory, if there's a big spend, then we all have to contribute to that.
Mark's service charge should cover a range of estate costs, but he says the service and maintenance is minimal.
And what do you actually get?
So what you're supposed to get is landscaping. So there's a number of green areas, there's a children's play area, there are footpaths there. All of these were supposed to be being maintained. What we get is a couple of people come around every other week and cut the grass. That's pretty much it.
Mark and his neighbours believe that although they'd be responsible for the roads above ground, the drains and sewers would be adopted by the local council. But that hasn't happened.
We get a bad smell from the sewers. We were of the understanding that both the fresh water and the sewage would be adopted by the relevant authority. We now find out that the local authority are going to adopt some of the sewers, but not all of them. Builders will blame the management company will blame the water authority, and then the water authority say, it's not our fault, go back to the builders.
When effective plans for maintenance are in place, private or unadopted roads don't necessarily cause problems. But it's important to know what the arrangements are from the beginning. Sam Alexander Lyon is a property solicitor.
What advice would you give to anybody who's looking to buy on a new build estate that wants to make sure that those roads are maintained in the way they should be?
There's probably four really sort of pertinent questions to be asking here. One, whether there is any intention by the local authority to adopt these roads, whether the developer has entered into any agreements with the local authority to adopt them. And then if not, what are the arrangements in place for when those roads aren't adopted? How much is going to be paid? Who is going to be dealing with the upkeep of those roads? And also the other amenities as well.
If you do live on an unadopted road, is there a way of the residents speeding up the process to the council getting involved and adopting it?
Honest answer, no. it's very much within the legal framework how long that takes, and it's at the discretion of the two parties.
As more new build estates remain under private management, either intentionally or as a result of adoption delays, understanding exactly who's responsible has never been more important.
The road outside your home may look and feel public and be used like any other street, but legally it may be anything but. If you already live on an unadopted estate, get the facts in writing. What is adopted? Who is responsible? What is still private? And what are the costs? And if you're buying, don't just check the house. Check the roads, sewers, drains, lighting, the estate charges, and whether adoption has actually happened, not whether it's expected one day.
Yeah, lots to think about. And I was just thinking about Dave there, who's been trying to get this sorted for 13 years, wants to just get on and live his life in his community.
But they're the kinds of things you don't think affect you until you come to sell your house or you have a problem. They're all things you need to get your head around
living
and factor in.
Yeah.
No arguing over who's responsible for the barbecue, though, because Bryony is in charge today.
Yeah, and if the hot weather has boosted your appetite for dining al fresco, Bryony is taking our grilling game to the next level. We've done a bit of barbecuing on the show. Now it's all about the marinade.
We're marination for the nation. I don't think that's actually a word, but we're going to make it one. Is that all right?
Yeah, I love it.
Great. OK, we're going to do three today. We've got garlicky chicken.
Oh.
We've got a miso soy salmon marinade, and we've got a bang bang cauliflower, which has got a lovely kick to it, a bit of spice. Ooh. It's got a little something for everyone.
Yeah.
Because I feel like in the UK, we kind of sometimes we stick to the more bland kind of sausages or burgers or chicken thighs, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But I think we can level it up a bit. Let's pack some more flavour in there.
I tell you why. Because when you might think I'll have a barbecue this weekend for the football, there's so much on. Burgers and sausages are easy, but you're saying this is as easy.
This is so easy. You're literally chucking a few bits in a bowl that you've probably got in the fridge or in the cupboard. Leave it for an hour if you can. Longer if you can.
Yeah.
And then that's it. It's soaking up all that lovely flavour.
Even if you don't have that time, it's still quite nice if you just do it as it is. Which one are you starting with?
We're going to start with the chicken.
Yeah.
Why did the chicken cross the road?
Don't know why.
Because!
That's
my daughter who's watching at home.
That's not bad. Not bad.
Right,
thank you,
Nora. So when you're marinating, your marinade needs to have like the golden rule. Okay, you've got three things. You want a bit of fat, like from yogurt or oil. You want a bit of acid from something like lemon, and a bit of salt. Okay, those are the three things you want.
Fat, salt, acid.
Very good. So we're going to start with our garlicky chicken one. We're going to add some olive oil into the bowl. We're going to, of course, add some garlic. Need a bit of that. Get that in there.
Well, you can really smell it, can't you?
Yeah, you can smell it, can't you?
Yeah.
Got a bit of lemon juice, that's our acid.
Okay.
And a bit of lemon zest as well for freshness. And then we've got our herbs here. I've got top tip for cutting herbs, because I don't know about you, but chopping herbs just can be a bit tricky sometimes. Put them in a bowl, get some scissors, clean scissors, and just snippity snip, snip, snip. And then
I use my scissors to cut a pizza. How do you feel about
that? I do that too.
Oh, great, validated.
Yes, honestly, it's the way forward. See how easy that is?
No mess.
No mess, exactly, right? So we're going to pop our herbs.
That's what I took from that.
Fresh herbs.
Oh, I've got. Smell that now.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it? So you've got some basil, coriander, parsley in there, whatever you've got to hand. If you don't have fresh herbs, just use dried ones. I'm going to pop that in there. That's literally it. That's our marinade. We're going to give that a mix, and then we're going to pop our chicken into the bowl. Make sure it's covered. Come out. There we go. Make sure it's covered.
Get rid of that and then wash my hands.
Lovely. Yeah, fabulous. Going to make sure it's covered. Then we're going to cover it. And then we're going to pop it in the fridge. You don't want to marinate your chicken for longer than overnight because the acid will start to make it not as nice. Exactly, yeah. So, you know, 6 hours if you can, an hour if that's all you got, okay? Don't stress too much.
An hour's enough.
Yeah, an hour is enough.
Okay.
Don't stress about it. So that would go in the fridge. Could you help me wash my hands, please, Catherine?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, thank you. And then once you've done that, then it's just ready to cook.
Okay. That looks easy.
That was so
doable.
Easy.
Okay.
Come on, thank you so much.
Should we try it now?
Go on, you guys try it while I move on to the next one.
Oh, you've done that one. Thanks.
That's how easy it is.
That's how easy it is. Ta-da! I'm going to move on now to one for the veggies out there. Okay, nice.
Well, just because I cook chicken all the time, it's quite nice having a bit of a variety, something different, tastes completely different.
Exactly. So for our cauliflower, now I've cut them into steaks, because, you know, it's a bit different. I never get steaks when I'm out because it annoys me that they charge £9 for basically what is essentially a wedge of cauliflower. But if you're at home, why not? So we've got some cauliflower steaks there, cut nice and thick. Yeah. And for this one, we're going to start with some Greek yogurt.
By the way, cutting them thick as well is key, isn't it?
That's absolutely key, yeah, for sure. So we've got some Greek yogurt. We're going to pop in some sweet chilli sauce.
Hang on, Greek, because I will do this. I love cauliflower.
This is so delicious, honestly. Sweet chilli sauce. Again, this is all stuff that you've probably got in your fridge or in your cupboard. Bit of sriracha, give us a bit of a kick. OK, nice bit of chilli. Going to get some lime in there as well. That's our acid. Some lime and some lime zest. I always put the zest in with these as well, because I really do think it adds a freshness. And then a little bit of olive oil.
Just keeping to that rule.
Exactly, the rule. That's all you got to do. And a little bit of salt.
Mm.
Actually, Geth, can you need salt for me? Could you? Thank you so much. Oh, beautifully done. There we go. And then for this one, if you're doing steaks, you want to brush it on with a pastry brush like this.
It's a bit like a burger sauce.
Yeah, exactly. It does, actually. Yeah, like that. So you're just going to brush it on until you've covered all the bits.
But I do feel like this is really elevating your barbecue game.
Yeah. If you've got florets, though, like this, if you're not going to cauliflower steak it, just take those, whack them in the bowl, cover them. Now, because it's a veggie, this doesn't need to marinate for as long. So you can marinate it for as little as half an hour.
OK.
So you've given us florets in our little tasting bowl.
Yeah, you've got some little florets in there. What do you think?
So with this, you just chuck it on the barbecue and let it...
Yeah, chuck it on the barbecue. If you don't have a barbecue, or for whatever reason the weather's changed, pop it under the grill, pop it on a griddle pan. There's loads you can do. Put it in the air fryer.
That is that's really good. If you said to you, I'm going to give you cauliflower, you'd be like, all right.
Yeah, that's correct. But that's all
right. That's cauliflower.
Kind of, yeah. It's kind of beating the chicken, that, for me, so far.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay, Which leaves us with
some salmon. So we've had our meat, we've had our veggies, we're now going to do some fish. This one is, again, stuff that you might find in the cupboard. We've got some soy sauce. We've got some fresh garlic. That's ginger. Then we've got fresh garlic. I get them jumbled up sometimes. I've got a bit of sesame oil. If you don't have sesame oil, a little bit of vegetable oil is fine. Just sesame oil adds a little bit more flavour. Again, we've got that zest and juice of a lime. And I'm going to pop my miso paste in.
So the other stuff I have, miso paste, where am I getting that?
Right, miso paste you can get in most big supermarkets these days. If you don't have any miso paste, you can just make it without. Maybe add a little bit more soy or add a little bit of ketchup in there.
Oh, that I've got.
My kind of cooking is just throwing stuff in.
Throwing stuff
bowl.
In. And there you go. So that's literally the marinade made. That took seconds. Yeah. Okay. And then with our salmon, because it gets quite flaky when it's cooked, you want to cook it in like a little foil parcel. So you just literally just fold some foil up and then pop the salmon into the foil. And then I'm just going to pour my marinade on the top. Again, with fish, you don't want to over marinate because the acid will get in. And like you said, it starts adjusting the texture. So about half an hour max for marinating the salmon, and then that's ready to go. Again, cook it on the barbecue, cook it in the oven, in the air fryer.
By the way, the chicken and the cauliflower actually goes really well together too.
Oh,
you do
nice.
Both.
Mm.
Not if you're a vegetarian, though.
Perfect.
No, but like, obviously. But...
it does. They all go very well together. Mm. Love it. The fish is really nice.
It's all fantastic. Thanks,
Pete. The recipes for Bryony's barbecue marinades are on the Morning Live website, bbc.co.uk/morninglive.
So easy. Now, from adorable animals to caring keepers, BBC's Animal Park has all the ingredients for the perfect heartwarming watch.
The hit series is back. Presenters Kate Humble and Ben Fogle take a look at a brand new park for the lions to play in.
You never learned, do you?
I know. I always eat and then talk.
The calm before the storm.
Oh, there's one, there's one. Oh, yeah, look.
Just jumped up straight up.
As we've learned over the years, enrichment isn't just about having fun. It's absolutely crucial for keeping this pride active, curious and mentally stimulated.
Oh, look at her.
It also encourages natural behaviours like climbing, stalking and exploring.
They're so we've got another female here heading for the scratching
She's
post.
She's headed for the scratching post now, look.
Look.
Is she going to put her paws up?
This might just be the lion's best ever day out.
She's loving the rope balls. Look at that. She's giving her a good old pull.
Wow.
look at
the strength.
Wow.
The muscles.
That is incredible.
Wow.
I mean, we love the lions, but Kate, we loved your reaction. After all of these years, you can tell they have your heart, don't they, those lions?
Completely. And it's ridiculous. You know, as you say, I've been watching those lions. I've seen some of those lions grow up literally from cubs to adults. And yet there is still something so incredibly exciting about seeing a lion in Wiltshire.
Yeah. Alongside Ben, who you've been with for 25 years on the show, and some people might have actually seen a special plaque that is in the Lion Park now to celebrate your involvement with the show in the park.
I know, which obviously made me cry. I cry all the way through this series because basically there were so many lovely surprises. And in fact, I can show you, look, they made us a little replica
of
the plaque. Isn't that gorgeous? So I have it here at home. So I can think, I mean, I haven't got any lions running past it, but I'll work on that.
Not yet. Listen, people love following the stories of the animals, but they love your friendship as well. Can you remember the first time you guys first started hanging out together?
I mean, the first time that I became aware of Ben was, I think, when everybody did, when he was doing Castaway. And I remember watching the programme, and I promise this is true. I remember seeing him, and there he was with his shirt off and his gorgeous dog. And I said, we could be seeing a lot of him on our tellies in the future. And the next thing I know is that he's got a job with me. And he came, I said, well, can I meet him first? Because, you know, we're going to be working together, and I'd like to know whether he's a decent sort of chap. And he turned up at my house with the dog. Dog ran through the house, straight into the pond, scattered pond weed all over the place, and made a complete mess. And I just thought, well, either I've got to hate him or love him forever. And I went for the loving because it was easier.
I tried that once, just walking in, you know, with the top off and, you know, into a show. Didn't get that. And then I started on Morning Live, which is a story for another day, Kate, you know.
yeah, well, do we do that after you come
on?
I'm
going to do this.
Kate, this is almost an impossible question for you, but which animals, what are the stories that have completely stole your heart over what, a quarter of a century of doing this?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I mean, there are, as you say, there are so many, but probably one of the things that really tells the story of how long, you know, Ben and I have been involved in the show is the story of Malaika. And she was this just extraordinary lioness. And we saw her being born. I mean, there she is with her sisters. And that was over 20 years ago.
Wow.
And we were there when she was born, and we saw her, you know, grow up, and she became, I mean, we all called her the queen of the park, but she really did become the kind of pivotal lioness of Harry's pride. And you know, last year, very sadly, we lost her. But she was, as I say, she was nearly 20 years old. She'd had this extraordinary life. She'd had cubs of her own. She left an amazing legacy at the park. And just to be part of an animal's history for that long is an extraordinary. I mean, I know we use the word privilege a lot, but in this case, it really is a privilege to be part of that story, of an animal's story for so long. And I think it's the thing that, you know, Ben and I, we were talking about this year, you know, we never get tired of the place. We never get bored of it. You're always surprised by what's happening. There's always something new. I mean, you both know, you know, anything with animals. Animals have this just brilliant way of always upstaging you, first of all, always surprising you, always doing something magical that is entrancing. And that's, you know, for 25 years, we've been entranced. How lucky are we?
But that love that you guys have shown, people buy into, and it's allowed people up and down the country who are never going to get the privilege of standing next to Malaika to feel like they have, because you take that lion to their living rooms, and it's testament to what you guys do, but it's testament to how much they really do pull on your heartstrings. I mean, you've seen both ends. She passed away, but you've also seen new arrivals, haven't you?
Absolutely. And I mean, this year we there were two hippos at the park at Longleat for many, many years, called Spot and Sonia, and hardly anyone ever saw them. They were fantastically grumpy girls, and they would, you know, spend most of their lives in Half Mile Lake with just their ears showing in the way that hippos do. And they both lived, I mean, well into their 50s, and then they died. We've got new hippos at the park now, and it's a very different setup. You know, they've come from other collections. They've built this amazing, I mean, it's like a 5-star hippo hotel on the banks of Half Mile Lake. And for the first time ever, you know, I've done a lot of work in Africa. I've done a lot of work with hippos. And one of the things that people always say is even though they're vegetarian, they're herbivores, they eat grass, they're incredibly dangerous. So, you know, you want to keep clear of hippos. I fed a hippo a cabbage. Oh, my goodness. It was just brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant. Just to get close to an animal, just to see the whiskers on the end of their noses, just to kind of see the size of the feet, how they move in water. To be able to be that close to them is really exciting. So, you know, having, as I say, having worked with hippos at Longleat for 25 years, suddenly to get that close to them this time, it was amazing.
It is amazing. We love to enjoy it as viewers too. Right, I'm going to set you a challenge now. In 30 seconds, you're going to tell us what we can look forward to on the new series.
OK, well, obviously, me feeding the hippos a cabbage. Ben would, if he were here, he would trump me and say feeding Anne the elephant a watermelon, which is amazing. He said it's one of the most, you know, social media friendly kind of extraordinary sights of an exploding watermelon in the mouth of an elephant. And the other thing is, of course, well, tigers, you can never get bored of tigers. White-back vultures have had a chick and they've successfully reared it themselves, having failed over the years. And they're birds that are, you know, not loved because they're vultures, but they should be because they're so important. So, and then there's just me crying all the time because everyone keeps saying nice stuff.
Why would you not want to tune in to see Kate crying in a new series of Animal Park? Goodness. It starts on Monday, 13th of July, 9:30, BBC One and iPlayer.
Yeah, but whenever she goes, I go, I'm like, the tigers, the lions, the bears. Listen, we know that Kate loves lions, tigers, rhinos. You've been hanging out with all of those, but you've also been spending time with some less exotic animals at home at the farm.
I have. You know, the sheep, all the lambs are out and growing like mad. We've had a good year, as you will know, Helen. You know, the grass is growing. It's hay-making time. We are literally making hay as the sun shines at the moment.
Keep up the good work. It's lovely to see you, Kate. Yeah. Kate knows firsthand how tough the work can be, and soaring costs of things like fuel and fertilisers mean some are struggling to make ends meet, a topic that's been highlighted recently on the hit series Clarkson's Farm.
But hope is not lost. We look back at when presenter James Stewart went to meet the business owners planting the seeds for the future.
You will no doubt have noticed the price of most foods getting higher recently. One of the reasons for that is the increased costs of producing the food. Farmers are being hit with sharp rises in costs of fertiliser, wages and energy used.
And that means that some farms that have been in generations of families for years may now be a risk. But necessity is so often the mother of invention. And it turns out our nation's farmers, well, they're a pretty inventive bunch.
Steve Denany has been farming this land in Greater Manchester for 36 years. And his connection to it stretches much further back.
My granddad was farming a long, long time ago. It'd be over 100 years, this has been the family farm.
But Steve has found it increasingly hard to make money through selling that more traditional farm-grown produce.
It's always been a gamble, farming. A few years ago, we had a really bad year on potatoes. We grew 270 acres of potatoes with a growing cost of, say, £70 a tonne, and we received £30 a tonne back to the farm, which is a huge loss.
So Steve was keen to find some other income streams. And there was one growing quietly right under his nose.
Half the field was already put aside because it's too wet. There's bulrush has been growing on there naturally. I've been working with Lancashire Wildlife Trust for a couple of years now. They bought some land not too far from here, and they approached me about doing a trial on growing bulrushes by another company called Ponder, who were involved with us on doing this scheme. We thought, yeah, why not?
Steve is in the early stages of farming bulrushes, which are used by a biomaterials company 160 miles away in Bristol as a natural insulation for jackets. Bulrushes, it turns out, are brilliant at keeping us warm. Julian Ellis Brown runs the company which saw the crop's potential for turning wetland wonder into winter warmth.
If I very carefully open it up now, you'll be able to see that it can expand up to thousands of times its volume. Each one of these clusters roughly mimics what a feather might look like. And we thought, well, feathers are used for insulation and jackets. How about we use this for insulation instead?
To insulate each jacket, about 20 bulrushes are needed. To grow the bulrushes, Steve needs to re-wet the fields, which has a really positive environmental impact.
When you drain a wetland, you expose that soil back to the atmosphere, and it just rots and turns into carbon dioxide and produces huge amounts of emissions. And when we re-wet a space, we stop that exposure of that soil to the air again. You lock it back in underneath the water.
We know bulrushes work well in wet environments like marshlands, but it also has to function in coats to keep the wearer toasty and warm, which I can confirm it does.
This kind of keeps you as warm as goose down would.
Absolutely.
Is goose down the most expensive kind of material for jackets?
It is, whereas the cheaper polyester plastic insulations are really cheap. I can completely understand why some people might choose cheaper alternatives, especially at the moment. But I think we've all got to think about the future and how we can make perhaps less but more careful choices about the clothes we're buying.
And Steve and Julian aren't alone. Growing plants for manufacturing rather than food is a booming industry. In 2022, a company called Knopla won the Earthshot Prize for its work using seaweed harvested from special seaweed farms off the coast of the UK to replace plastic containers. Pierre Palier is co-CEO.
What makes seaweed such a good material for packaging?
It grows extremely fast. Some species can grow up to 1 meter per day. You don't need to give it fresh water or fertilizer or any kind of like pesticides.
And Pierre shows me how it's done, by extracting a white powder from the flower of the seaweed that is then blended to create a honey-like mixture.
What you're going to do, you're going to take this.
Can I do this?
Yeah, like a few milliliters. So here we go. That's it. Perfect.
Oh, no.
That's all good. All right. And now you're going to slide this across, and it's going to spread very thin. Here we go. And now we're going to take a salt that is found commonly in the ocean. So if you take this bottle and you're just going to spray it at the surface.
Yeah, I'm happy with that.
You can actually start picking it up from this side.
No
and you
way.
See it's going to turn into a solid.
Just
yeah, start peeling it.
Oh my gosh.
And you can take it and here we
my
go.
Word. That's
you've
a
made a film from seaweed.
And Knopla has developed a unique way to deliver instant hydration.
So this is a little bubble that is encapsulating a little bit of water inside of a film very much like the ones you've created.
31. Oh my God.
That's it.
It's like flavored water.
Yeah.
So we encapsulate like all sorts of different juices, flavored water. We use it for energy gels as well, for marathons, for runners. So we can use it in lots of interesting places where you would otherwise use a plastic cup or bottle.
I find it amazing that materials occurring on our farmland and in our oceans are now being used to make more sustainable versions of the products we use every day. Britain's inventive, clever family farmers have always fought to keep producing valuable crops in challenging circumstances.
And while we still do need to grow our own food, it's really encouraging to see that same sentiment being applied today, but in a new battle, the fight against climate change.
I found the conversation between James and Julian fascinating there about the evolution of farming. No?
And that's how it survives. We live on an island, so you've got to look at what you've got, haven't you?
Absolutely.
Loads of you have been joining in today's conversations. Before we get onto them, though, Thursday, I want you to put a little note in your calendar. Make sure you send some questions for our team because it will be time for Ask the Experts on
Very
Thursday.
Demanding, but you're quite right. Here's who could answer. And you can ask them absolutely anything you want. It doesn't have to be about a topic we're covering on the show. It can be about something in your life you're hoping for a bit of advice on.
Add our number to your phone, 0800 032 1100, or you can scan the QR code that is on screen. I don't know why I tried to do that because it's always over there, isn't it? Make sure you pop Ask the Experts in the message along with your question and your name.
Time to answer a few of your questions on the show today. Nick has been talking about scammers preying on people with missing pets using AI-generated photos. We're talking about Stephanie and her cat, weren't we? John's been in touch to say, would it not help to prove It is actually your lost pet and not a scam by asking for a short video, or can they be faked easily as well?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And unfortunately, yes, they can also be faked very easily. So I think the solution in this case is, if you're not certain, you're not ready to go and meet that person face to face, say to them, can we have a video call?
Ah.
So that you can see it as a live video, because then hopefully, well, indeed, they might deepfake their face if they're a scammer, but that's probably too much.
OK. Video call is good, though.
Yeah, you can't deepfake a cat.
You have to be aware of everything, don't you?
You've also been sending in questions for Dr. Ranj, so I'm going to dive into a couple. Jeanette says, Ranj, I've been prescribed a cream which says to store below 25 degrees. During the heat wave, the house was hotter than that at times. Can I store it in the fridge? Worth asking, Jeanette. We've predicted some warm weather later this week, aren't we?
Exactly. We're about to be hit with another heat wave around various parts of the country. And whilst we want people to be really mindful and look out for things like heat exhaustion and heat stroke, remember, you've got to look after your medications as well. So we're talking about things like insulin, certain antibiotics, some creams, like Jeanette was just saying. By all means, please check the packaging. And if it says store within a certain temperature range, you can pop it in the fridge. If necessary. So ideally store them in a cool, dry place, and if it's really, really hot, pop it in the fridge.
Actually, I had quite a few questions about cream, so thank you very much for that. Dr. Ranj, it's nearly time for us to say goodbye, but before we do, we always do our minute of exercise. Today it's with Montel. Cue the music.
Yeah, we're celebrating summer holiday season with a sunshine-themed Strictly Fitness, and today it's the lobster claws from Dan Walker and Nadia's Chai.
A classic, Helen called it earlier.
Frankly, I don't think you need anything else if you've got a lobster claw, but we like to warm up, so what are we doing first?
Of course we do. Very lovely thing. So we're starting off with some wood chops today, which we are chopping wood. So we're going to be reaching up to one side and bringing down. If we're standing, we're going to a little squat. Just reach up to opposite side. If we're seated, reaching up as far as you are comfortable with your arms reaching to the other side all the way down. Lovely. Then we're going into our side reaches, OK? So the standing leg that you're going to be still, you're going to reach up with that arm. So this leg's still, we're going to be right leg over left leg, and we're going to reach up. Seated, we can use our shoulders and our arms if we feel comfortable. Opposite side, reach down, and just nice stretches there.
You should feel that in
your stomach, or we call them your obliques, this side bit here. And we're going into our lobster claws, OK? So this is the classic. Look, see that? Classic. We're going to lobster claws, so we're going to...
You've built this up now, Montel.
We talked about being being quiet earlier. We're going to go across like this, almost like we're telling people to talk, OK? So lobster claws, shimmying with our shoulders. If we don't want to bring our arms up as wide, we can do a nice little shoulder shimmy. I know you like a shoulder shimmy, Gethin.
Always
show us exactly what to do.
Let's take it away. Take it away, Alan.
With an upper body workout, it's Montel Dallas.
Let's go to the wood choppers and down. And again, we're going to go to the other side. Just even it out. Reach up and down. Just squat down as far as possible. Nice. Side reaches. So round, reach up.
This will get rid of the tiredness. Need a bit of exercise.
I'm going to have a hip on the side for in a second.
Let's go to those claws.
Be asleep by the end of Strictly Fitness.
Nice.
Correct. I love that.
Let's chop some wood.
Oh, I did.
Speed up a little bit if we like. And reach.
I've always wanted to do this while I do a lobster claw. That's all we've got time for today. I'll be back tomorrow at 9:30 with Rav Wilding, where we are chatting to our very own Sarah Cox. She's just finished her first BBC Radio 2 breakfast show. Head over to BBC Sounds to listen back. See you tomorrow.
I'm back Thursday. I'll see you Thursday.
Disinformation. You think you're winning. Fooling people in the most sophisticated ways. But it's because of you we get up in the morning and work through the night 24/7.
We're very powerful.
So no matter how hard it gets, we'll always pursue the truth. The fight for truth is on.
Every morning should feel like this. Adventures in Classical. BBC Radio 3 Breakfast. Just ask your smart speaker to play Radio 3.
Hello, I'm John Taylor, puzzle consultant.
Crime scene consultant.
That does sound more like an actual job. That sounds good, doesn't it?
From Liverpool, Kent and Norfolk, bringing you the best property tips, Homes Under the Hammer in half an hour. Now on BBC One, our expert witnesses are back for a new series.
This time, when a young woman is gunned down in her home, detectives turn to a firearms expert to crack the case.
The Scorpion machine pistol would fire in fully automatic mode between 14 and 15 cartridges per second.
And will a forensic scientist's high-risk DNA strategy put a sex attacker behind bars?
We'd have to get the material off the tape-in, and we only had one shot at it.
Welcome to Expert Witness, the series where we reveal how science helps solve some of the UK's toughest criminal investigations.
Liverpool, Merseyside. At around 12:30 on the 21st of August 2022, Merseyside police are called by concerned neighbours and race to a property on Leinster Road.
Where is the police? Does anyone here make yourself known?
Butchers with taser.
Police arrive at Ashley Dale's house. They find the front door kicked in and the lights still on. There are bullet holes everywhere, shattered kitchen tiles.
Back door is open. Thanks.
And at the back door, they find a woman, fatally injured.
Lying in the back garden, they find 28-year-old Ashley Dale. She appears to have been shot and dies of her injuries later in hospital. There is no one else in the house. BBC journalist Johnny Humphreys was a crime correspondent for the Liverpool Echo and was there for every moment of the trial.
We heard the name of Ashley Dale quite early on after the news broke that somebody had been murdered. She was actually the first woman who was shot dead in Liverpool in over 17 years, so it was a bit of a shock.
At the time of the incident, Mum Julie, partner Bobby and Ashley's two younger sisters were all asleep.
We were woke to a knock on the door. Come looked out the window and there was two plain clothes police officers. And they said that there'd been an incident at Ashley's property at her home.
The police then revealed that Ashley had died.
Fell to the ground, just couldn't believe. It was like someone was just... like I was just looking into someone else's life at that moment in time. I've got... sorry... these two young girls upstairs, I'm going to have to just completely shatter their lives to tell them that the big sister who they love is just not here anymore, and that was just horrendous.
Julie gave birth to Ashley when she was just 16 years old.
As Ashley got older, we did grow up together. People like used to think we were sisters. We were literally like best friends. She was great. She loved life. She was very glamorous. Loved her clothes, loved shopping, but also loved her home as well and loved being at home. She went to university and she did a degree in environmental health, and then she was working as an environmental health officer with Knowsley Council, and she just had a promotion in, you know, within her work.
The council leader from Knowsley, where Ashley worked, paid tribute to what he described as a rising star within the council. Colleagues left flowers on her desk in tribute to the woman who was killed.
As Merseyside police began a massive investigation, Ashley's murder received intense coverage in the press, and the shocking events of the night were revealed.
Ashley was home alone. She was on her living room sofa watching the television. Gunman bursts in, fired multiple shots throughout the house, and Ashley was struck in the abdomen. Ashley's car, that was parked on the street, and the police noticed three of the tyres on the car were slashed.
Police say it was a targeted attack, but that Ashley was not the intended victim.
It wasn't long before detectives focused their investigation closer to home.
We started to get rumours coming in about her boyfriend, that the name Lee Harrison started to emerge. He didn't have any kind of legitimate job or legitimate income. He was involved in drugs.
Voice notes recovered from Ashley's phone revealed that Harrison was involved in a feud with a second drug dealer, Niall Barry.
There's this background of escalating tension and anger between the two men.
Ashley's family had no idea about Lee Harrison's criminal connections.
Ashley had been with Lee about 5 years, but we never really knew a great deal about him in the beginning, and I felt like she did keep it quite quiet.
Lee Harrison was interviewed by police about the shooting, but claimed he had no idea why he or Ashley would have been targeted.
In Liverpool, if you're known to be a grass or a snitch, then that doesn't go down very well with, you know, these types of people who are involved in criminality and organised crime and stuff like that. So a big wall of silence went up on that side in terms of, like, Lee and Lee's friends. How could someone who claimed to love my daughter so much not speak up or not want to try and help the investigation?
The police brought gangster Niall Barry in for questioning.
He was arrested outside of a hotel and he had a bag of cash, I think around £10,000, with him, a big bag of clothes, and he was clearly trying to get out of the country.
But he had an alibi for the night of the murder.
He was in his flat. He was with a couple of other guys who was watching boxing and UFC. There were CCTV cameras covering the front at the entrance, so they could see he hadn't left the flat in the hours leading up to the shooting, so they knew he couldn't have been the gunman, and at that stage they didn't have anything to keep him in custody.
This was a big setback for the investigation. Facing a wall of silence, the crime scene and forensics were going to be pivotal in solving this case. So police enlisted the help of forensic firearms expert Andre Horn.
When I arrived, I did an initial walkthrough of the scene just to get an idea of what physical evidence is immediately apparent. I could see some forensic markers where police had already identified some bullets and cartridge cases that they had observed.
Andre's first task was to examine the discharge casings and bullets to establish whether there was more than one weapon used at the scene.
This is a comparison microscope, and it is something we use to compare the firing marks on bullets to one another. We'll mount a bullet on the one side, and then we will look for a significant unique mark, and then see if we can find that same mark on another bullet. If we find the same marks on the same two ammunition components, we can then come to the conclusion that they had been discharged in the same firearm.
Andre was able to identify not just that the ammunition came from the same weapon, but the type of weapon used.
Cartridge cases, in this case, had dual ejector marks, which is very particular to a specific type of machine pistol called a Scorpion. The Scorpion machine pistol is a very compact weapon, and you get magazines with different cartridge capacities. It is a very rapid-firing gun. It would fire in fully automatic mode between 14 and 15 cartridges per second.
Andre hoped that forensic examination of the bullet casings found at the scene could help identify Ashley's killer.
When cartridges are loaded into a firearm, they are handled by a person, and that person could potentially deposit their DNA on the cartridges.
Meanwhile, detectives analysed the CCTV outside Niall Barry's flat from the evening of the murder.
Inside the flat, in the hours leading up to the murder, were Niall Barry, Sean Zeiss, who had a beef with Ashley's boyfriend as well, James Witham and Joseph Pearce. And police were able to record on CCTV Joseph Pearce and James Witham leaving the flat shortly after 10 o'clock on the 20th of August.
The footage also showed the two men heading towards the car and leaving in the direction of Ashley's address.
It was quite a distinctive Hyundai, and they'd had that on CCTV going into Ashley's road, and then leaving again around the time of the shooting.
Messages sent from Ashley to her mum just before midnight revealed her car alarm had gone off, helping detectives to reconstruct the events leading to her death.
One of Joseph Pearce or James Witham slashed the tyres on the car in an attempt to lure whoever was in the house outside.
Investigators' theory was that when that didn't work, the gunman had burst through the front door, showering the inside of the house with bullets. The net was closing in on Pearce and Witham, but they needed to link them physically to the crime scene. But then they got the breakthrough they needed. DNA found on a bullet casing came back with a profile.
James Witham had left a piece of DNA on one of the bullet casings that was found in Ashley's property. The evidence was beginning to become overwhelming.
This is the moment James Witham was arrested.
What's your name, fella?
Francis.
Say that again.
Francis Cullen.
He gives a false name, but eventually admits who he is.
You're under arrest for a suspicion of murder.
Joseph Pearce was also arrested.
They were interviewed over the course of a couple of days. Both of those men answered no comment to all questions.
Two family liaisons came to our house and they said they told us the names, James Witham and Joseph Pearce. And we were like, who? Who are these people? We'd be shocked because we didn't know, we'd never heard of them before.
With Witham and Pearce not cooperating, detectives set about making the case against them watertight, starting with the vehicle that was seen on CCTV, parked outside Barry's flat, then driving to and from the scene.
The police were able to recover the car and it was examined forensically and swabbed for DNA. And one significant finding in that was the DNA of Joseph Pearce on a bottle cap inside the vehicle.
That linked Joseph Pearce to the car. The shoe prints would further strengthen the case against Witham.
On the front door of Ashley's house was a footprint. The police were able to tie that to James Witham. He was seen on CCTV buying that exact pair of trainers within the days and hours before the shooting.
The footprints on the door, the DNA on the spent cartridge and DNA found in the car all pointed to Witham being the shooter and Pearce being the driver. Confronted by the evidence, Witham confessed, but not to murder. He claimed he was just firing warning shots rather than targeting Ashley and that her death was a tragic accident. Could ballistics expert Andre Horn disprove Witham's testimony and prove he had intent to kill?
During the autopsy, I found that Ashley had been shot once and that she had an entry wound in her abdomen and an exit wound in her left lower back. And that was very important for us to determine where actually Ashley had been standing when she was shot.
A bullet with Ashley's DNA was recovered from a kitchen chair, indicating it had passed through her body and lodged there.
The chair was standing adjacent to the kitchen counter and the bullet lodged into a wooden support inside the chair. The bullet impact marks tell us in which direction the bullets had been fired, where they had struck, in other words, where the gun was pointing at the moment of discharge. We know she was in the living room where she was watching television when the shooter came through the door.
Ashley made her way to the kitchen where the fatal bullet was found. By recreating where Ashley was standing when she was shot and using a laser to mimic the bullet's path, Andre could determine where the shooter had been located.
The image that we see here would have been the viewpoint of the shooter as he was looking through this doorway. We then extrapolated the trajectory towards where the shooter had been standing. And we had a tripod. And where that tripod then intersected, we knew that that was most likely the position where the shooter had been standing.
From this, Andre was able to recreate the events moments prior to Ashley's death.
The first shots were discharged by the shooter when he was standing in the hallway. He had then progressed further into the dining room towards the kitchen, where some further shots were fired. It is at that point that Ashley was fatally wounded.
Andre's analysis put the lie to Witham's defence. He hadn't fired shots randomly. He'd chased and murdered Ashley as she fled the room.
During the course of our examinations, it was apparent that the shooter had been following Ashley and that he had pursued her.
Both Witham and Piers now faced a murder charge. But as the long-standing feud was between Ashley's boyfriend and Niall Barry, police strongly believed he and associate Sean Zeiss ordered the attack. And as luck would have it, they were already in custody for unrelated offences. That meant that police were able to analyse data on all four suspects' phones.